Alors, c'est un plaisir pour moi maintenant de vous présenter celui qui va animer la prochaine session. It's a pleasure for me to introduce the man who will be hosting the next session. I almost said something embarrassing, but Damien Siles, il occupe le poste de directeur général du quartier de l'innovation de Montréal depuis le mi-juillet 2014. Durant ces 6 dernières années, il fut le directeur général et fondateur de la Société de développement social de Ville-Marie, premier quartier social en Amérique du Nord. Je connais Damien depuis quelques mois. Je peux vous assurer qu'il connaît tout le monde à Montréal. Il est impliqué dans beaucoup de projets très, très, très intéressants et fascinants. Et il nous a semblé la personne idéale pour animer cette session qui touche sur tout ce qui est numérique et urbain. Damien?
Merci pour cette introduction, professeur Stroh. C'est avec grand plaisir que je modère cette série de présentations sur les enjeux du numérique, un thème qui a une portée internationale et surtout innovatrice, et surtout avec des penseurs locaux et internationaux. En tant que directeur général du quartier de l'innovation, un écosystème d'innovation de Montréal basé sur le savoir et à l'écoute d'une communauté innovante, je suis vraiment heureux aujourd'hui de guider cette discussion et surtout curieux d'entendre les idées des panélistes. Les métropoles aujourd'hui sont en mesure de stimuler la participation citoyenne, l'innovation, la créativité pour trouver des solutions aux problèmes sociaux. Ideas for creative cities, smart cities, green cities, sustainable cities and wired cities represent bold new thinking. It is clear that cities are busy reinventing themselves and the future. Today, we will explore how we can make a city more equitable, innovative, and participatory. During this panel, we will hear from experts in digital cities, smart cities, creative, and open cities from Montreal to Vancouver. Unfortunately, we learned yesterday that due to an important conflict in commitment in Mexico City, Gabriela Gomez-Mont will be unable to travel to Montreal to be here today. She was sorry to have missed the conference and the wonderful winter that we have right now. However, I'm very happy to say that she was able to arrange a Skype appearance and is now joining us live from Mexico City, where she is the director of the Laboratory for the City, a creative think tank, an experimental space to place to ponder social scripts and urban futures. So, I'm going to ask each speaker to give their presentation, and after each presentation, we'll take a few questions from the audience. First of all, Madame Jessia Adcock, Chief Digital Officer, City of Montreal, responsable en chef des services numériques, Ville de Vancouver. Monsieur Arouch Itilian, Vice Chair, City Council Executive Committee Montreal, Vice Président du Comité Exécutif Ville de Montréal, qui est dans la salle, qui va venir nous rejoindre. Stéphane Guidouin, Director Products and Services OpenNorth.ca, Directeur de Développement des Produits et des Services OpenNorth.ca. Et enfin, Madame Gabriela Gomez-Mont, Directeur Laboratory for the City, Mexico City, Directrice Laboratoire de la Ville de Mexico. So, our first speaker has traveled from the city of Vancouver to be with us today. Mrs. Jessie Adcock is Vancouver's first Chief Digital Officer, a role she has held since 2013. Mrs. Adcock is technology, marketing and digital professional who has been employed globally within the high-tech sector since 1988. She came to the city from a global financial institution where she held a series of senior roles in marketing and IT with responsibilities for developing and implementing the company's global digital strategy, application development and online service delivery for consumer and business market. Je laisse la parole maintenant pour 20 minutes à Madame Adcock.
The weather in Vancouver this week, 15 degrees. Yeah, not to rub it in or anything. Thank you for having me here. I'm going to talk about digital issues as they pertain to cities. So just a little bit about my background. I have never worked in government until now. And so I've been in government for the last year, basically to execute Vancouver's digital strategy. And some of the stuff that we heard earlier from Stratford and Halifax, we very much recognize in Vancouver the need to transform ourselves, both the innovation culture as well as our technology culture, and we recognize that that was a very essential part of the city's ongoing success. So what we're trying to do in Vancouver is build a digital city. This is an actual drawing from a discussion that was had with both the external public, business, internal staff members, during a conversation about what does the future for Vancouver look like. This was part of the actual planning process and the building process for our digital strategy. At the time, what they recognized was that there are so many things that are floating around in terms of buzzwords. You know, there's smart cities, there's gigabit fiber, sensors in homes, beacon technology, privacy issues, security issues. What does mobile first mean? What does digital first mean? And I think a lot of the people in this room probably already understand that, but in the construct of government, it's not necessarily known by everybody automatically. And so what we really needed to do in Vancouver was to, one, lay out an end vision that said, what does that end vision look like? And in the case of things like online services, it looks like being able to do everything online and not having to come to City Hall. In other cases, in the sense of consultation and planning, it means being able to participate in the actual municipal dialogue online, virtually. It means having a presence in areas where your public is. So, for example, you know, there's so many dialogues and conversations on Twitter. The governments need to be there. The governments need to be part of those conversations. Otherwise, you risk alienating the citizens of the city. So the first issue was actually recognizing the need. And I think one of the themes earlier on was things happen so slowly. Things happen, you know, via bureaucratic process that doesn't make sense. And I think number one is recognizing the need, but then also getting the whole organization on board with that need. And what Vancouver did, which I think was pretty good in the sense of being quite modest and humble about where they were, is they recognized that they were actually very early days. They recognized that they had no digital maturity when compared against other global cities. So the starting point was to say, where are we right now? And this chart, basically, the big green circle is Vancouver. And what they did is they looked at where we were. Now, this assessment was done in 2012, so we have moved the dial since then. But we saw that we had a long way to go. And what we did was we looked at four different sections in terms of digital maturity. We looked at, you know, online presence, what we offer, how we communicate with our stakeholders, how we govern, how we participate where we are. We looked at mobile. An interesting fact is that this year in December, almost half of the traffic, online traffic coming to our website is now over a mobile device. So it's been hovering from 40 to 50% for quite some time. That's like a very, very significant piece of information when you consider that 50% of your interaction during a particular month. And I'll tell you another fun fact. Our highest traffic spike ever, aside from our November election, was Boxing Day last year. So interesting behavioral patterns like that, that if you're not actually involved in this sort of digital paradigm, you wouldn't know that more Vancouverites visit the website on Boxing Day than any other day in the year. Social. We recognized that we needed to be involved in the dialogue on social media. We needed to evolve and mature, you know, our presence and our utilization, and also to some degree without being Big Brother or monitoring. Infrastructure and data, some of the things I'll touch on today are related to that. You know, fiber optic is now as valuable as gold in some municipalities, and municipalities have a very, very strong responsibility to pave the way for what broadband connectivity is going to look like in municipalities. Recent studies indicate that people equate broadband access with human rights. And so we have to be very, recognize that need and plan for not the current needs, but also for the expansion needs of business, the expansion needs of families and homes. We also have to work, you know, collectively with the various players in that telecom market to make sure that we put in place some strategies to build out fiber and also Wi-Fi. Why is the strategy so important to our city? And I think this would probably pertain to any city in the world, is that the innovation outside of government is changing expectations for how government should behave. An interesting thing, though, is when you're a commercial brand, you can often build a business case for investing in digital, whether it's, you know, how good your user experience is, how much effort you involve, how many clicks does it take. So, for example, right now, to register for a yoga class in Vancouver, it takes you 19 clicks. In the commercial world, that wouldn't really go over very well with most consumers. However, when you don't have a choice to go to any other community center, you sort of just have to grin and bear it. So the business case is very hard to make for digital in government. However, what we are noticing is that the mobile shift, and what we mean by the mobile shift is that citizens are now interacting with us on their smartphones and not necessarily coming in anymore. So what we have to do is we have to respond to that shift by having channels open for people to interact with us and get all of the services that they need, as well as get access to any information that they might require. Another interesting reason that this is all important is that the availability of mass data has created not only pressure from inside government, but also outside government. Younger, more innovative startup companies have expectations that we should make the data available, and I'll touch on that a little bit too. So our strategy, and what I'll do over the next sort of 15 minutes, is I just wanted to give you a flavor for what our strategy is, and then I'll touch on some of the initiatives within the strategy and the challenges that I think that we're facing. Engagement and access. We have four pillars in our digital strategy: engagement and access, infrastructure and assets, digital economy, and then organizational maturity. The first pillar contains a number of initiatives where we look at increasing the number of online services, we look at increasing digital literacy and making sure that people across the city have access to internet so that we don't create haves and have-nots. We're also thinking about creating more of a customer service paradigm around channels. So right now, most of the governmental organizations are siloed. They don't talk to one another. So your parks organization might not talk to your roads organization that doesn't talk to your, the people who pick up the garbage on the weekends, who might not talk to fire and they might not talk to police. So as a result, the citizen themselves is caught up in a web of confusing rhetoric and the web of confusing access issues, and they feel disengaged. And I think that if we're going to build success in the future on cities, we need to peel back that disengagement a little bit. And the way you do that is by creating, borrow or steal a marketing term, delightful experiences. Now, I don't think it's probably realistic to think that the governments could create delightful experiences, but you at least have to, try to achieve some of that. In terms of infrastructure and assets, we currently have no strategies that actually inform how we want to build out our broadband for the generations to come. And as you can imagine, data consumption is going up. And so we need to build out that infrastructure, much as we build out our sewer infrastructure, our water infrastructure, our utilities infrastructure. Partnerships, we talked about PPPs a little bit and the lack of funding being a huge challenge for municipalities. I think that's probably universal. So as part of our digital strategy, we opened up a mechanism for us to be more creative in terms of partnerships with private enterprise so that we could bring in things, that are important for Vancouver's public. Digital economy, our startup culture and our innovation culture is very, very thriving in Vancouver. And what's interesting about our strategy, it also encompasses techniques and projects and initiatives that are targeted at creating opportunity to create jobs and retain talent within the city. It's very important for us to have a thriving technical culture, and so part of our strategy looks at that. And then finally, digital maturity within the organization itself. You can't do anything outside if the culture inside doesn't change. So we have 15 priority initiatives, and I won't go through them all, but essentially, more of what I've already said. We want to enable more services across platforms. We want to expand open data. I'll explain that a little bit. We want to do more in terms of communication and engagement using tools, social media platforms and online tools. And I think that a lot of the younger demographics would appreciate that more. What's interesting, though, is that most of the voting public is probably the folks that are now the fastest growing segments on social media channels. So we never would have expected this to have happened. I think probably traditional thinkers within municipal government thought that that's just for the kids, and what's happening is actually not just for the kids anymore. So, just I guess in terms of those 15 initiatives, it's a four-year strategy, and then the first thing falling off the back of the council approving that strategy was bringing somebody in to execute said strategy. So they looked outside of government, and I probably got, I guess, what is the coolest job in Vancouver if you're in my, or coolest job in the country for that fact if you're in my field. And I feel very lucky to be a part of it. We have a council that's very dedicated to the strategy. We have a city manager and senior management who are all very dedicated. So, you know, I feel really good about the fact that Vancouver's journey from where they started to where they ended would probably, you know, stands to succeed given the fact that we've had all of the enabling things lined up. So we had a strategy, we had senior support, we have public support, the citizens supported as well. There's a real momentum that's built up behind this strategy. But it doesn't come without challenges. So executing the strategy, I'll just, you know, briefly touch on a few of our initiatives and the challenges that we've faced. And I think maybe to take away from some of the discussion points here is how can we help our cities that are resource constrained, that are dealing with, you know, floods and fires and catastrophes on a daily basis, how can we help them to innovate without necessarily having to have them buy products from us? So the biggest thing that we can do is how can we enable cities to grow and mature in ways that you don't have to go through procurement cycles? I think those are the ideas and the innovations that will help our cities grow. So challenge number one, issue number one, is moving to a digital culture. So I was just talking earlier about open data and how, you know, there's a lot of folks who want open data and the government should put all their data online. And I said, well, so most of our data is on clipboards. So the problem is that you can't really open up your clipboards. So moving to a digital culture is probably the most important thing. In order to do that, though, we need to be able to champion internal tools that allow us to collaborate. So when I started with the city a year ago, Instant Messenger did not exist within the city's sort of standard desktop rollouts. And so I was very much a meeting-oriented culture. So I felt like I'd walked through a time portal and I'm like, oh, I can come from the future. You know, you should see what the future is like. We have Instant Messenger. We have all the, you know, online booking tools. To talk to somebody, you would have to pick up the phone. This is just a year ago. Pick up the phone, set up the meeting, maybe leave a voicemail. And then somebody has to pick up that voicemail. Maybe they don't get you and they call you back, all to ask a simple question that with Instant Messenger, you could really just ask the question and be done within 5 seconds, right? So we talked about this, and immediately the default reaction was, okay, we need to build a training package, and we need to create training for all the users in the city. And I think what's really important here is that you don't actually need all that stuff. You get your iPhones without manuals. There's no reason why you can't roll out things like this in this day and age to people without having to overcomplicate, overanalyze, and overthink some of these deployments. So I think it's really important to demystify what digital culture means, and all we're really talking about is embracing technology to maybe allow us to do things a little bit faster, a little bit quicker, and maybe in a little different way. In the end, because we know that critical mass has already, this pendulum has already swung towards some of these tools, we don't necessarily need to do a business case on everything to know that actually this already works. So if it already works, let's just do it and save our energy for stuff that requires real problem-solving time. So one of the things I think also is understanding, the next issue that I want to talk about is understanding this notion of digital first, mobile shift, and what now much of industry is calling omnichannel citizen engagement. So I worked in the retail retail sort of online, setting up websites in the late 90s, and, you know, how do you take a credit card online? How do you build a website? How do you do, you know, transactions between I bought something, now I have to send it to a warehouse so that they can ship the product? That was kind of what I did for the first 10 years of my career. The second 10 years was about banking and how do we take what is a traditional business model and move it online. In those days, people thought, actually, you're never going to be successful because people will never stop going to a bank. Well, guess what? How many people here go to a bank, right? You don't go unless you have to go sign something or if it's too complex a transaction. So I think what is happening right now is that a lot of vendors, software vendors in that, are really starting to gang up on government a little bit and trying to create these notions of, you know, these new buzzwords. And that's because government is greenfield. There is actually untapped resources. There's a lot of work there to do. But I think that one of the issues or one of the solutions perhaps is that municipalities and working together could probably achieve quite a bit of synergy because they have the same problems. As we heard the panelists earlier, it's sort of the same problems whether the cities are smaller or larger. And so if some of the solutions already exist, maybe let's not replicate too much. So in this sense, omnichannel citizen engagement is really about turning on all of the channels by which your customer engages with you and having it available to you all the time. I think in retail sectors, you can buy a car or whatever, you know, go to Best Buy anytime. They don't close their shop at 9 o'clock. They don't close their shop at 6 o'clock. I think that's where we need to get to with government services. We also have to recognize when we build a new service. So if we're designing, a new process, for example, where a new type of license that the city might want you to acquire, we need to be mindful of the fact that we should design these things with only digital in mind. So you should design them for the web first so that people will naturally gravitate towards them. I think in government, one of the issues is that tendency is to design these things, overthink them and over-engineer them to be a face-to-face experience, and then we kind of automate them. That's not necessarily how people are building online experiences anymore, so we need to help government overcome that. I think I'm probably going to be over time, so I'll move a little quicker. We need to modernize citizen experiences a little bit. We have to use the native features in our phones, for example, to do stuff, again, logically, the way that the public wants the items to be there. So if you're on your phone and you're reporting a pothole, there's no reason why we shouldn't be able to use the location services built in within your phone and have you instead have you fill in your address, right? So there's things like that logically that we should be doing. One of the things we've been experimenting with in Vancouver is actually embedding real-time engagement. So we have this swim lesson registration that occurs a couple of times a year, and it is, you know, we get bombarded by thousands of users during a 10-minute window because all these mums and dads want to register their kids for swimming lessons. And if you don't get the right level, I mean, I know I'm a mom. It's the end of the world. So what we've done is we've actually created web pages where we embed APIs for Twitter on the top half of the page and then the registration software on the bottom half of the page so that the park board can communicate to the parents as and when the classes are coming up for registration. So again, stuff like that that doesn't cost a lot of money, but is really changing how we deliver service. Smart cities is the other one. So this nexus of green and digital is quite interesting. I think smart cities now is becoming such a huge issue. I was recently at a sustainability directors conference in San Francisco, and it is very much a case of data. How do we use the data? How do we have smart long-term decisions? How do we create these sustainable green futures for our families? And I think when we look at what we need to do to design these smart cities, cities need to stand back and be very mindful of what it is that we're trying to achieve on a long-term basis and then come up with strategies to get there. So part of that is getting ready for the smart home, whether it's thermostats or whether it's you know, your phones or your stoves or your, you know, now a lot of people don't have phones anymore. So all this data being collected by the different, I'll use the word from earlier, orders of government. So depending on who delivers your hydro, who delivers your phone, who delivers what, there's a lot of data being collected. And I think at some level, governments at all levels should be mindful of the fact that we need to understand that there's this tsunami of data coming in and out of homes now that we have to prepare for. Wi-Fi is a big one facing cities all across the globe. And so like most other cities, that's one that we're contending with as well. Again, we are trying to leverage knowledge on how industry is going and how much data is being consumed and how valuable city assets are to leverage those city assets and our footprint in these urban centers to get free Wi-Fi from the vendors. So we're trying to work with them on these like creative partnerships to get Wi-Fi across the city. We're trying to demonstrate, and we're being quite successful here, in the need to have like a comprehensive fiber and broadband strategy. Again, data consumption's going up like this, and we need to make sure that we have connectivity coming in and out of our cities that can support the data needs of our public. Enhancing open data and governance, this is also a big one. So again, we want to make sure that we open up data. This is an example of data that we opened up. We basically put all of our garbage pickup schedules, all the data online as a data set, and then a local company has built an application that now allows you to get a push notification when it's time to pick up your garbage. So this is one of our most heavily used applications. So if there's ever any issues, you get a text right away that says, oh, sorry, you know, we missed garbage pickup in this area and we're going to be late. And it's dramatically increased citizen engagement because folks are happy that we're telling them something, and technically it's not hard to do. Connecting the dots, which is probably always the hardest thing about data or in digital culture, is making sure that there's just so much to do, and there's always going to be a lot of critics. And one of the biggest issues that I find in digital is that everyone is an expert in digital because everyone uses the internet. And so it's really hard to have productive conversations when most of them are usually people very critical of what you're trying to achieve. And it's a little difficult sometimes, but you have to understand, again, having those end goals in mind really help. And that's where the digital strategy in Vancouver is really useful for me. I have a very clear end goal for 2016, so it allows me to focus on what we need to champion. I think I'm probably running over now. Vancouver has the very, very ambitious goal of being the greenest city on Earth by 2020, and we are driving towards that goal. It's such an important goal to all of us inside City Hall and outside City Hall. And what we've actually recognized since I came on board working with our green team is that there is a really, really interesting nexus happening where green and digital intersect. Whether it's clean tech companies are also technology companies. Technology companies are also sustainable companies. The data that's garnered off of all of that, and what we've really been doing is trying to support innovation at the nexus of those two items. Trying to create a legacy for technology and social innovation is another digital issue. This is an old police building that we're converting into an incubation and acceleration hub. And so we'll have really neat architectural features. But the idea is that the floors will be dedicated to not just technology. One floor will be for technology innovation, one will be for arts, one will be for social innovation. So it'll be quite good. We're continuing to do this, and it's attracting IT sector investment. So we now have Microsoft moving in their largest non-US development center into Vancouver in the coming year. We have Amazon in town. We have Facebook in town. We have a number of different folks coming into Vancouver as a result of not only the ongoing efforts of the digital strategy, but they're actually paying quite a bit of dividend. That's good. Yeah. I mean, I could go on forever, but basically, I would just in conclusion just leave these four thoughts. Is when we're building the digital cities, we have to do four sort of key things. One is to understand our citizens. We have to factor internal and external need. We have to be willing to change culture and face resistance. And we have to have a vision and dedicated leadership. Sorry for going over. I could go on forever.
Merci beaucoup, Madame Alcock.
On peut prendre deux questions, oui. Now it's possible to ask to have two questions. So if you have questions,
donnez votre nom et d'où vous venez, s'il vous plaît. Name and job. Personne? Ah, madame.
My name is Alison Hackney. I'm a McGill alumna. And my question is about what happens if you should have the bad luck to lack power, as we did in Quebec for, you know, several weeks in 1998. Then what happens with the digital revolution?
Merci. It's working?
Is it working?
Microphone. You have it.
I think we need you know, power redundancy issues. I think a small thing like that shouldn't be able to bring down your entire city's digital strategy. I mean, I think at the end of the day that, yes, that prohibits us from operating. But it's all about an evolution, I think, not a revolution. This is a recognition that our society is evolving and we need to evolve government to keep pace with the change in society. Our governments are very old and traditional, and our society has evolved and become quite modern and technological. So a power failure in that, absolutely, we need to have, you know, emergency management processes in place to deal with those kinds of things, because they will cripple a town in certain cases. But I don't think it should detract us or distract us from the fact that we need to have this innovation happening inside government.
Parfait. Deuxième question, monsieur.
Ah, pardon.
So we have a combination of both in British Columbia. I'm not sure around the rest of the country what it's like, but we have some of our municipalities actually building out their fiber networks and then getting status to be able to resell that internet. I think our legislative framework and how we're governed by the CRTC, there's things that we can do, there's things that we can't do, there's change that we can do quickly, other changes we can't make. I think at the end of the day, for me, what's most important is that the city should have broadband. And this, you know, we should try to get as much fiber to as many houses as possible within any kind of geographic boundary. And if in the States they have the ability to do that completely in a contained manner and empowered to do so, that's great. I think for us in Vancouver, in Canada, we have different challenges. And I think we should try to maximize working with the telcos to maybe reuse their capabilities. There's also a significant amount of capital investment that goes into laying this fiber, and cities don't have that kind of capital money. We're talking billions and billions of dollars. And I know we said there was a Build Canada fund earlier that you can apply to, but again, even that takes manpower and resources to apply to those kinds of funds to make the case. So do I think the city should be leading the charge? Maybe not necessarily on the physical deployment of the fiber, but I definitely think they should be establishing, like, how much fiber do we need, and that we actually need to make sure that we have these broadband capabilities throughout the city.
Thanks a lot. Merci beaucoup. Now, our next speaker is a familiar face to those of you who follow municipal politics. Pour un deuxième mandat consécutif, Arut Chitilian, qui arrive, a été élu conseiller municipal du district de Bordeaux-Cartier-Ville de la ville de Montréal en novembre 2013. Au sein du comité exécutif de la ville de Montréal, il occupe le poste de vice-président et il a la responsabilité des dossiers reliés à la réforme administrative de la ville intelligente, des technologies et de l'information, ainsi que les dossiers jeunesse. Afin que la métropole devienne un chef de file mondialement reconnu parmi les villes intelligentes et numériques, la ville de Montréal a créé le Bureau de la ville intelligente et numérique, dont le principal mandat est de définir la stratégie Montréal ville intelligente et numérique 2014. Autour des quatre axes suivants, collecter, communiquer, coordonner et collaborer. En 2014, il reçoit le prix de la relève de l'Union des municipalités du Québec, remis à un jeune élu de moins de 35 ans qui s'est illustré sur la scène municipale. Monsieur Arut Chitilian, pardon, devra quitter après la période de questions qui suivra sur sa présentation. Il est retenu par d'autres événements par la suite. Donc j'appellerai Monsieur Chitilian à venir. Merci beaucoup.
Merci beaucoup, Damien. Thank you very much for that introduction. First and foremost, I just want to congratulate the City of Vancouver. The presentation was quite inspiring. But besides the inspiring presentation, also I see a trend here. Vancouver, Montreal, Stanley Cup Finals, maybe, yeah? and definitely to bring the cup back to Montreal. You know, you guys can be in the finals. That's okay. Yeah. Can we have an applause for the Habs winning the cup this year? Why not? Yeah. Great. I'm sure they can hear us right now.
Also, I would like to also give my warm greetings on behalf of the mayor of Montreal, Mr. Denis Coderre, to all the mayors that participated previously on the panel, Mrs. Crombie. I saw you guys on Power and Politics. It was amazing. And looking forward to seeing all the federal parties give a follow-up to all the different recommendations that came from that very interesting discussion. There was Mayor Haig too, Matheson, Savage, and Mayor Simon from Châteauguay. So the mayor salutes everybody. And also a colleague of the mayor, the Honorable Marlene Jennings. I don't know if she's still here. She left? Okay, he wanted to send his greetings to Mrs. Jennings. So let's start with the City of Montreal Digital Strategy. It's in French, but we have an English version. You can go on the website. It's called villeintelligente.montreal.ca. So villeintelligente.montreal.ca. All the documentation is there, French, English, and you can look up a lot of different interesting case studies too.
Je vais faire cette partie-là en français. Donc, la stratégie de la ville de Montréal, avant tout, est une stratégie qui est collaborative.
Quand on est arrivé au pouvoir au mois de novembre 2013, il y avait un choix très, très important à faire.
Est-ce que par souci d'agenda et d'échéancier politique, on allait accélérer un projet fédérateur pour avoir des livrables à très, très court terme en définissant les besoins à la communauté ou on allait prendre le temps pour définir un processus qui est un processus de dialogue permanent et ouvert et transparent, pour définir une stratégie, pour définir des projets et surtout après communiquer les réalisations et faire adhérer l'ensemble de la communauté dans ces réalisations. Donc, la stratégie est en 5 étapes. On a passé l'étape donc de la vision. Il y avait 4 verbes importants, donc collecter, communiquer, coordonner et collaborer. Consulter les citoyens, donc il y a eu une période importante de consultation publique, également des sessions de co-design, notamment une qui s'est tenue ici au Centre Phi. Dépôt d'orientation stratégique qui s'est fait tout récemment et également priorisation des projets stratégiques qui vont émaner des orientations stratégiques. Donc, pour la partie écoute, basically it was in 5 steps, our strategy. The first step was to define a high-level vision. Then it was to engage the community, but also look at interesting case studies. So we looked at 7 different cities, Eindhoven, Lyon, Barcelona, Toronto, Columbus, New York, Arlington, and today I looked at Vancouver, so we can add even 8 to that. We analyzed a lot of data, so we had close to 1 million calls that were made to 311 service. So we analyzed the pain points. What were the citizens telling us in these calls? We also looked into the different emails that we got over the years. And finally, we conducted 4 surveys over the phone to see what were the pain points that the citizens brought up on a regular basis. And last but not least, we held 5 different sessions with the citizens, consulted over 400 citizens, to identify the key elements of the strategy. So let's look at our findings. First and foremost, the analysis of the international scene, okay? As we saw with Vancouver, a smart and connected strategy for a city has 2 different elements. So you've got the structural elements, telco, open data, policies, and infrastructure. And you also have cities concentrating their initiatives in 6 different areas. So transport is very, very common, very popular. Citizen services, the public space, public domain, democracy and transparency, sustainable development and economic development. So here are some projects, and I won't go through them, but some interesting projects. So you have the 22 at Barcelona, which is an area that they set up to have initiatives. You have the City of New York 311 service and the website that's quite interesting.
also Mayor Bloomberg's project to replace all the street lighting with LED, 250,000 lights for energy savings. So there was a lot of interesting projects that we identified across different cities in the world. And another interesting project that we really took a close look at is Optima de Lyon. The city of Lyon, and we met with the mayor of Lyon, is approaching smart cities from two angles. Energy consumption, so they have the smart grid Lyon, and also transport and urban mobility. And urban mobility means, before developing the services, also developing the data architecture, because every single piece of data that is generated from a public transit service provider in Lyon is centralized in one area, and they've created an application that allows somebody to go from point A to point B based on real-time data that they get from all the different providers. What are the priorities of the citizens of Montreal? So basically, for us, the citizens told us, concentrate on the five following things. First, urban mobility, public transit. It's a nightmare to get around in the city of Montreal for numerous reasons. We have a lot of construction sites in the summer. We have snow removal in the winter. So that was number one for the citizens. Develop digital tools to help us get from point A to point B. Second is try to become as connected and as digital as the private sector for citizen services. So as far as paying your taxes, booking courses for your kids, for swimming, etc. Also, they told us to work on transparency and democracy, develop digital tools, and it's not enough to have a web broadcast of all our different sessions. They want more. And last but not least, all of this has to come together and lead to something tangible, which is economic development for the city of Montreal and all its citizens. What are the strengths of the city of Montreal? So we are already considered as a smart city. We made the top 21 of the ICF in 2013. We have close to $21 billion of gross domestic product generated from the IT sector, 10 living labs, 11 different university institutions, 750 Wi-Fi access points, 170,000 students, 150 research centers, 8 industrial clusters, and so forth. So the base is extremely solid. That's where we need a direction, and we need to build on this momentum to come up with tangible results. So what is the framework that the city of Montreal presented to its citizens a couple of weeks ago? It's basically, instead of having three structural items, we have four, because for us, besides telco, open data, and their infrastructure, we need also to engage the community, because the community is an enormous wealth. I kind of draw the parallel between the wealth of knowledge that the community has and the hydroelectrical dams, because this energy is confined. And as long as we don't harness it, we don't make the most of it. And we tapped into it by organizing a co-design session for a snow removal app. And we held our first co-design session in the month of May. And when we were organizing the session, people told me, you know, Harut, you'll be lucky if you have 20, 25 people show up. It's 31st of May. It's a sunny day. I said, look, we don't have any windows inside, so that's a given, that's a plus for me. And never underestimate the citizens of Montreal, because they're engaged and they want to participate. 110 people showed up to co-design the snow removal service. And then we organized a challenge. We challenged the community to develop the application, and we had 16 different companies develop prototypes for it. And we chose one of the prototypes to become the application of the city of Montreal. Yes, it has issues because of the data that we're providing to this application, but in the first year, in the first 3 weeks, we had close to 60,000 downloads. So the need is there, the community is there to help, you just have to tap into the community. We have also five specific areas we want to focus in. So, like I said, urban mobility, citizen services, develop also an urban layout that encompasses smart development, have more transparency in economic development. So I'll skip through all the different, there's specific targets for each structural area, and I'll go right to, because there's an important part, which is, what do we do with all this? So we have four structural priorities, and we have five specific areas that we want to work in. We can't do everything. As a public institution, we got to first and foremost, I think it's Socrates that said that, the wise are those who admit that they know nothing. So we're admitting that we have limits, okay? Our limit is we will promote some projects and we will be behind some projects 100%, but we also need to play a role to support existing projects from universities or even Quartier d'Innovation. Damien here works at Quartier d'Innovation. We also need to facilitate different groups to come together and to create synergies. So the city has three different roles to play in order to make the strategy a reality. How do we choose the projects that we will promote? That's an important aspect too, because we have now numerous ideas, close to 232 ideas that we collected from citizens, from employees. We have different projects that we identified from across the world. And how do we choose projects? How do we identify the key projects? That's where we defined our filter. And we defined this filter with the citizens of Montreal and the community. And there's five criteria that will allow us to judge a project and an action and prioritize them. First and foremost, what are the impacts on the strategy itself? So does it match our strategic priorities? What's the return, the ROC, the return on the community? We're not only talking about ROI here. Cost return benefits, that's the fourth element. And the fifth is the lead time, because we are dealing with, we need to catch up on different cities, but we're also dealing with a political timetable. We have a mandate, we have 4 years, it's already 16 months done, 32 to go. So we need to deliver certain services to show that the strategy had feet. And last but not least, once we start and initiate the projects, this is quite interesting. We took this from the UK digital strategy. Basically, we will classify the projects in four different categories. We already started classifying them because there's some projects that are in the discovery phase. Some are in alpha phase, so prototyping, beta, which is the prototype is done and we've tested it, and in operation. So once we put in place the different projects, any citizen can go any time of the day on the website and see in real time where the different initiatives are at. And last but not least, all of this, we need funding. So the city of Montreal has done two key decisions. First and foremost, from an IT perspective, there's an enormous gap that we need to make up. So we've taken the budget of the capital investment budget from 80 million to 240 million over 3 years for the next cycle. And as far as the smart city initiatives, we've also dedicated $23 million to execute the different projects that we will promote. I know what some of you are thinking. Is this dollars for big corporations? And my answer is no. And first and foremost, we intend to do a lot of small projects with the startup community, and we've done the snow removal project. We recently did a contract and a transparency package. Basically, any citizen will be able to go in a couple of months and see which company got how many dollars in which area, from what date to what date, and that tool is being developed by Nord-Ouvert, and Stéphane is involved in Nord-Ouvert. And we have to also reinforce the expertise of the city of Montreal, because the number one mistake that a lot of cities have made in developing digital strategies is that they confine the execution and the management of these initiatives to the private sector. And we need to keep a control on the steering wheel, so we need to reinforce the expertise, and in the coming weeks, we are going to announce some changes from that regard at the city of Montreal. And the third piece, and it's an important piece, so reinforcing the expertise, dealing with small companies, and the third element is sourcing. Because the legislation that is in place right now at least at the provincial level here in Quebec, does not allow us to do certain things that are being done, for example, in the city of San Francisco, for example, to confine a certain percentage of contracts to companies that have small market capitalization. So the legal framework right now, and that's something we also intend to change. We have submitted a request to our legal services, and in the coming months we will address it to the Quebec government, because we need to have a more nimble framework to do all these things and to get the best return on every dollar of public money spent. So that was it, and now I'm ready to answer any questions. Thank you.
Donc, un, deux, trois. Celui-ci. Deux questions, s'il y a des gens dans le public, monsieur. Votre nom, vous pouvez aller au micro, peut-être ? Nom et l'endroit d'où vous venez.
Oui, merci, Harout. Peut-être qu'une partie, there's a piece that maybe you have not had the chance to address, which is the project that you're actually supporting 100%, you presented, but the other projects that you would like support as a facilitator. So let's say there's a bottom-up approach. How do you facilitate? Let's say we have ideas, or the citizens or companies have ideas to propose to the city. How do you integrate that into the strategy?
It's a very good question. First and foremost, those who live in Montreal know that we had a very, very interesting summit called Je vois Montréal, and that brought together the whole community. And from Je vois Montréal, we've already inherited some projects that made a consensus in the community. And from those projects, we are actively involved to either facilitate, promote, or even execute those projects. That's a given. That's one. Second is, we want to involve the community by creating specific programs for entrepreneurs to submit ideas, or even identify the needs of the city and then go back to entrepreneurs to execute on those needs. And that's the second aspect. And the third, which is going to be a very important piece of the framework, is that we want to create a hub that brings together universities, the city with its needs, the private sector, and the people who have the capital funds, and create a startup hub for smart cities. Because in the city of Montreal now, we're very, very honored to have a hub for web development, which is Nutman House. A couple of weeks ago, I was honored to open also a hub for indie video game development. But I think now it's time also to have a dedicated space where the city can put up the needs and some dollars, the private sector can finance those projects, and also the universities and different companies can come and provide assistance, because the market for smart initiatives is going to be huge. And right now, it's only the big players that are positioned, but there's a lot of room for smaller companies to occupy some strategic spots, because it's a wide open market right now.
Une deuxième et dernière question, madame.
Oui, merci. I'm Sharon Jeannot. I'm from the Centre on Governance at the University of Ottawa. And my question has to do with the CV part. You said that citizens' knowledge is like, you know, the hydropower behind a dam if it isn't used. And I was wondering, how have you built in any feedback mechanisms on these applications that you've described in these new initiatives that are going forward? How are you going to know if they're working, and how are you going to assess whether they're, you know, citizens are actually using them? And most importantly, are you going to have a means of getting feedback to improve them if they're not working as well as you think they should be?
It's a very, very good question. And I would say, first and foremost, besides the citizens, and that's one aspect that I didn't touch on the presentation, another key element of making any digital strategy a success is the public administration. We have 28,000 employees, and we need to get each and every one of those 28,000 employees on board, but also create mechanisms for them to give feedback. Because in the past, one of the risks that we need to manage when we develop the projects is change management. And just with the snow removal app, and I'm transparent, we had a lot of issues with the data, but we also had issues with citizens
not being able to understand how the tool works. So that's an area that we need to give a particular focus on, which is prepare the change, explain the change, but also we have a channel to listen to the feedback that comes from the change that we initiated. So with the citizens, but also with the employees, because we're also developing some projects that will touch the employees. We are completely redefining the workspace. We want to turn the workspace from a physical space to a virtual space where people have all the different tools in the virtual and the web environment. But before we do that, we have to work on the strategy to manage and to induce that change, but also to listen for the feedback. And it's a very good point that you brought up. Merci, thank you. Sorry, I have to leave.
Merci beaucoup. Merci beaucoup, Monsieur Chitilian. Maintenant, our next speaker is very well known within the Open Data Movement. Stéphane Guidouin est directeur de développement des produits et du service de Nord Ouvert d'ATCA, un organisme sans but lucratif qui crée des outils en ligne afin d'éduquer et de permettre aux citoyens de participer activement à la démocratie canadienne. Stéphane est un des leaders du mouvement des données ouvertes depuis 2006, année où il a cofondé Access Civic, le premier mouvement canadien faisant la promotion des données ouvertes. Au sein de Nord Ouvert d'ATCA, Stéphane se concentre sur les questions de standardisation des données ouvertes, des créations d'outils et de développement d'écosystèmes autour des données ouvertes. Donc, j'invite maintenant Monsieur Guidouin à venir faire sa présentation. Merci.
Thank you. Since I was with experts coming from cities that know more than me about how things work internally, I tried to do a presentation that is taking another angle and looking at cities and intentions of all the players, all the people who are involved in the city. Why intention? It's because when I'm not developing software or doing something with open data, I like to spend some time on the tatami to do Aikido. And one of the things is that an attack that you receive is really different depending on the intention that the person that attacks you. And it's a bit the same in how we live in the city and how we design our city, depending on the intention of the citizen, intention of the policymaker, and so on. Sorry. So what people want and how digital technologies can help to improve that. When we speak about digital, we have to understand what it is. Now it has become everywhere. We have it in our pocket. But we have to understand that digital is about putting things into numbers, which even for very advanced use like natural language analysis and things like that, is still about putting real life into numbers, into tables, into arrays. And it comes with constraints. And we have to understand what we can do with these constraints, but what prevents us also. Most of the things that are being done with the so-called smart city is about optimization, optimizing the city to make it more efficient, more useful for most of the people. It's not everything, but it's something that we hear a lot. What is optimization? Sorry, I'm going too fast. Yeah, that's it. So that's optimization, okay? I won't explain you what this is. It's, if you remember when you were at school, polynomial equations, that's what it is, but a bit more complex. What we try to do when we do optimization is to optimize several parameters at the same time. So on the left, theta 0, theta 1, theta n are all these parameters. And sometimes they are not going in the same direction, in the sense that when you optimize one, you have difficulties to optimize the other one. What does it mean in plain English for, I mean, everybody, most of the people? Transportation. It's one of the things that we like to optimize and we would like to optimize. And Mr. Chetillion was explaining how Lyon, the city of Lyon, for example, is trying to improve that. So that's the intersection, one of the intersections in Montreal with the most dangerous for pedestrians. There is digital optimization, but there is also what we did in the past to optimize. So what was done here was to optimize traffic. And what did we do to optimize traffic? We built those streets that allow right turn very easily, but which are not protected for pedestrians. So we decided to do optimization of traffic, and we decreased the level of security for everybody. That's something that is very easy to do when using digital technology also, to forget one of the criteria or several of the criteria to optimize one. And it's built within the tool in the sense that it's not necessarily you, or it's not even the elected people who decide what will be optimized. Most of the time, it will come with the tool that is being used to optimize, and it doesn't always tell you very clearly how it's being optimized, how to make it happen. I mean, it's very easy to optimize us. I'll leave it here. It's very easy to optimize traffic. I mean, you can have sensors. You can have something that tells you at every second at what speed cars are going. It's much more difficult to optimize security. It follows what we call the law of small numbers. Even one of the most dangerous intersections has something like 30 accidents over 5 years or 4 years. So at any instant, I can decide to improve speed. But it's very difficult for me to see what's the improvement I can do to security, because I can have 1 year without an accident and I say, yeah, I did it, I improved it. But in fact, the next year, you will have 5 or 10. So it's not me, I swear. Oh, maybe there is a timer. Okay. It wasn't supposed. That's not there. Okay, we'll do it with it. So it's very... It's very easy for an algorithm to be blind to some of the parameters that are the most difficult to measure. And that's one of the key aspects. It's very easy to measure speed of cars. It's much more difficult to measure security, for example. So people, not data. More and more cities are using massive amounts of data, we were speaking about that, to do analytics. And it's good. It's what we call evidence-based policy or whatever. It's what have made medicine, for example, much more efficient over the years. But on the other hand, you cannot treat, I don't know, weather data the same way you treat behavioral data, in the sense that one has no intention, except if there is a God that really dictates the weather, but one has no intention as opposed to... From where to where I'm going and what transportation I'm using, those are behavioral data. So there is that book which is named Dataclysm, but the interesting is the subtitle, who we are when we think no one's looking. So it has been made by the co-founder of OkCupid, which is a site de rencontre en ligne, and he's analyzing data coming from that site, and he says, you know what, based on what people are doing on my site, I know who they are. So one of the things is that he discovered that men tend to prefer women who are 22 age old, even if the man is 50, 60, whatever. So he says, okay, there's a bias, this is what people are, but is it what people are for real? And the intention, I mean, for him, the intention is that all men want 22-year-old women. Is that the case? So the first thing is it acceptable to deduce intention based on data without consent? Because all these conclusions that he's getting, nobody knows when they are playing on OkCupid, then every single click that they are doing will be used by someone to say, okay, all men prefer, or at least all men using OkCupid prefer women of 22 years old. For me, there is several levels into an intention. There is the instinct one, which is what some people will name the Freudian id, which is our pulsion. And most of the time, this is hidden. That guy was able to see it because indeed he was able to spy what people were doing while they thought they were just in front of the computer. there is what people think is moral to want, in the sense that on OkCupid, in the end, most of the people, even men, will try to match with women almost the same age. And there is what people do by vexation, in the sense not being able to get what they want, so they draw back on something else. So, for example, on OkCupid, you have some stars. So I can be 3 stars, and a girl could be 5 stars. Most of the time, I will not try a 5-star because I know that I will be rejected. That's what they see, and that's the truth. So that's something that we do by a vexation. What I'm trying to explain here is that there are different levels of intention. What is seeing on the first level is something that we usually don't see. What the third one is what is usually apparent. It's what being apparent when I'm looking people taking their car to go to work. It's what they are doing maybe by vexation, in the sense that maybe they would have preferred to walk or to bike or to use public transportation, but maybe those options were not available for them. So usually what we see when we are using data collected by Smart City, for example, is the third one. In my view, the interesting one is the second one, which is what people want and what they would to prefer if they were not facing vexation or things like that. So the idea, and that's my temporary conclusion, is cities must try to connect to people's intention, and that's not an easy one. So Mr. Chitilian explained what was done for the smart city and digital strategy. That was consultation, co-creation workshops, citizen chats. And that's interesting because it's really a way to connect with people's intention. And it was done in a way to animate the people and to really try to bring them to say what were their intention. Not to say, okay, I want to drive my car and whatever, but to go farther than that. Why they were doing that and how. But that's in technological world, it doesn't scale. You can do it for hundreds of people. When you speak about transportation, housing, sustainable development, you want to talk to 100,000s of people. So how do we do that? So you can ask people, citizens, to transform their intention into data, and then you can use digital technology to scale, to be bigger. And you know what? We've been doing that for a long time, which is voting. The issue with voting is that, well, it's one or zero. It's either you want that one or the other one, which is not very detailed. So one of the things that we are doing at Open North is online budget consultation. It's a tool that cities can use to publish what is their current allocation of budget on different activities. And citizens can say, okay, I want more snow removal, but hey, you end up in a negative budget, so you have to cut somewhere else. So it's really bringing people to more complex, more detailed data that you can put. So it's really asking people to transform their intention, I want more snow removal, into data that can be processed at a large scale. And it's also forcing people to do choice, which usually is much more difficult. So now I speak French. I've been proposed to do both French and English, so I'll do it. Here is a nice pseudocode of what change of language in software development can be. Why I'm doing that is because you see FR_CA, it means French-Canadian. I'm saying that I will switch to Français-Canadien. If you heard me, you know that I'm not French-Canadian, I'm French-French. But I'm living in Canada, but software are just able to say either you're French-Canadian or French-French, but I'm both. If you hear me, you will know that I'm French, but when I go to France, people know that I'm not French, or not anymore at least. So that's one of the thing and one of the issue with software development and digital world is that you're creating buckets. And you know that you're limiting yourself into a bucket. Intention of the policymaker and the data. So that's the other way around. The other one, I try to transform intention. Oh, j'avais dit je parle en français, pardon. Dans le cas précédent, on a essayé de transformer une intention en données. Là, c'est l'inverse. Comment les données peuvent informer, peuvent influencer les décisions? Et c'est très intéressant parce que donc il y a un article qui est ressorti récemment qui s'appelle « The Strange New World of Evidence-Free Government » où au Royaume-Uni, le Royaume-Uni qui est le leader en ouverture de données ouvertes, en transparence, tout ce que vous voulez, ils sont number one, il y a une série d'articles qui est sortie qui montre comment le gouvernement n'utilise pas les données pour prendre des décisions. C'est intéressant. Donc ils disent « oui, oui, transparence, etc. » mais quand vient le temps de faire les décisions, quand vient le temps de couper de l'argent dans les budgets d'aide aux personnes à faibles ressources, là, il n'y a personne qui va vérifier dans les données quel va être l'impact sur ces gens-là. Est-ce que ça va augmenter le taux de suicide? Est-ce que ça va augmenter je sais pas quoi? Il y a un pays dont le drapeau est une feuille d'érable qui a un peu le même problème quand il coupe dans le census. Je suis désolé, ma switch est pas passée en français. Dans le recensement. Merci. Ou plus récemment, le gouvernement québécois aussi qui a coupé dans des budgets en disant très naïvement, oh ben on n'a pas vraiment fait d'évaluation de ce qui allait se passer. Plus proche de nous, il y a le prolongement d'une autoroute, qui est autoroute 19, dans lequel, là encore, on veut augmenter des tuyaux, et pourtant toutes les données montrent que ce n'est pas une bonne chose. Pourquoi? Il y a deux choses. La première, moi, c'est une loi qui est quasiment aussi universelle que la gravité. Toute infrastructure créée pour régler des problèmes de congestion va empirer les problèmes de congestion. Donc, quand on dit qu'on va régler un problème de congestion en créant une autoroute, en général, c'est une mauvaise idée. La deuxième chose, c'est qu'il a été démontré que quand on augmente les tuyaux, ben, on augmente le nombre d'accidents. On en revient à la slide précédente au sujet des accidents. Donc, est-ce qu'il y a du monde qui a regardé les données qui existent? Malheureusement, non. Tout ça pour en venir, donc, on a vu les citoyens, on a vu les politiques, les prenants des décisions. Et moi, ça m'amène aux questions de tout ce qui est le processus démocratique. Je parlais de vote. Bizarrement, l'avènement des technologies numériques arrive en même temps que la baisse de tout ce qui est engagement. Les gens votent moins, les syndicats sont en baisse. Et on a des outils, ce dont on nous dit, qui vont permettre d'améliorer l'engagement citoyen, d'améliorer la transparence. Comment? La question, c'est comment? Et la question, c'est est-ce que c'est réellement quelque chose qui va arriver comme ça? Et si c'est pas comme quelque chose qui arrive naturellement, comment on fait pour le créer? Les outils numériques sont bons, sont de très bons agrégateurs. C'est très très bon pour mettre plein d'informations qu'on agrège, puis c'est ce que fait Wikipédia. Le problème, c'est qu'avec des outils comme Wikipédia, on a l'impression que soudainement, le numérique rend tout possible. Non. Wikipédia marche parce que c'est un agrégateur et parce que ça va très bien dans les concepts numériques. Je vais me battre avec ça jusqu'à la fin. Mais c'est un spectre, en fait. On part de l'agrégation, on a après les éléments de collaboration et les éléments de prise de décision. Comme je disais, agrégation, c'est bon. Collaboration, on a des outils en ligne qui commencent à être pas mal bons. Prise de décision, c'est beaucoup plus difficile. Et avec la prise de décision, vient tout ce qui est la gestion du pouvoir. Qui a le pouvoir là-dedans? Qui décide en bout de ligne comment les choses vont se faire? Les outils numériques ont le moyen de changer ça, mais par défaut, ce qu'on voit, c'est que les outils numériques tendent à concentrer le pouvoir plus qu'autre chose. On parle souvent de désintermédiarisation, mais souvent, en fait, tout ce qu'on fait, c'est on enlève 10 intermédiaires, on en rajoute un qui est plus puissant. Donc, de mon point de vue, de mon expérience, de par des outils, des choses qu'on a vues, c'est possible d'éviter ça. Mais c'est juste que il faut vraiment que les outils numériques qui sont bâtis soient pensés pour éviter la concentration de pouvoir et pour permettre l'organisation, la mobilisation et la prise de décision. Et c'est par ces approches-là, et puis je dis pas que j'ai la solution à tout, je dis pas que j'ai une vision claire de comment on va s'y rendre, mais c'est par ces chemins-là qu'on va permettre de recréer vraiment ou de renforcer les processus démocratiques à l'aide des outils numériques. Organisation, mobilisation, c'est intéressant parce que c'est des choses qui historiquement se font en dehors des gouvernements. Donc un des éléments qu'il faut retirer de ça, c'est que c'est pas nécessairement les gouvernements qui doivent prendre l'entièreté de la charge de réaliser ces choses-là. Mais il faut qu'ils le soutiennent. Dans le sens que quand ils mettent en place des outils, quand ils mettent en place des processus, il faut qu'ils soient faits en pensant à rendre possible et à faciliter l'organisation de la mobilisation. Et en bout de ligne, la prise de décision. Le but, c'est d'en arriver à un passage dans le sens que les outils, les données, rentrent dans un cercle vertueux avec les citoyens et avec les organisations gouvernementales. Ça a l'air évident comme ça, c'est l'air d'une lapalissade, mais ça ne l'est pas. Le défaut de la façon dont c'est bâti habituellement, c'est on a les citoyens, on a les données, puis on a le gouvernement entre les deux qui gère comment les choses vont se passer, ce qui n'est pas ce qu'on veut. Donc tout ça pour en venir à la conclusion. Se baser sur les intentions, comme je disais, c'est l'air d'une lapalissade. C'est l'air tellement évident qu'on se dit ben, on ne peut pas faire ça. Pourtant, si, par défaut, la façon dont les outils numériques sont bâtis a tendance à permettre ça, a tendance à aller sauter directement à la conclusion de ben, j'ai une formule mathématique, j'ai optimisé mon affaire, puis la solution c'est ça, puis on l'applique. Puis si on s'en tient à ça, on prend des gros risques. On prend des gros risques parce qu'on va arriver avec des solutions qui en bout de ligne ne correspondent pas à ce que les gens veulent. Donc l'important, c'est vraiment de trouver des moyens, et comme je le disais, c'est pas évident, on travaille, nous, on cherche à faire ça, puis on n'a pas toujours des succès, il y a des fois on se loupe, mais d'arriver vraiment à des outils qui permettent d'extraire les intentions et de discuter sur ces intentions plutôt que de sauter directement à « j'ai des données, je les optimise, voilà le résultat ». Merci.
Merci beaucoup. Est-ce qu'il y a des questions? Une question. Moi, j'ai le droit de poser une petite question. Lundi dernier, on a reçu Steve Wozniak à Montréal. On lui a posé la question dans quoi il investirait prochainement. Il a parlé dans tout ce qui est outils numériques, etc. Mais il a mis un mais parce qu'il a peur de la vitesse où ça va, où le développement va et comment on peut après contrôler ou perdre le contrôle de tout ça. Qu'est-ce que vous en pensez?
Bah, en fait, c'est beaucoup dans justement l'intention qu'on met en développant ces outils. Puis tout à l'heure, Monsieur Chilian parlait des processus d'approvisionnement. C'est un élément très intéressant parce que la façon dont ça marche à l'heure actuelle, puis ça va être extrêmement difficile à changer, c'est on a des requis, puis à partir du moment où on a un outil qui remplit ces requis, ben on va l'acheter. Puis le problème, c'est que souvent, on peut pas ouvrir la boîte. On sait pas ce qu'il y a dedans. On sait pas comment ils ont été bâtis. On sait pas c'est quoi les priorités qui ont été mises dedans. Et on se menote nous-mêmes à des technologies qui vont prendre des décisions pour nous. Quelque chose que j'ai dans la présentation, puis que j'ai oublié, mais qui est un peu en lien avec Steve Wozniak. En 99, Lawrence Lessig a écrit un livre qui s'appelle Code is Law. Ça a été écrit en 99, à l'époque où Internet était relativement naissant. Et tout le monde regardait avec des gros yeux en disant, bah, quand même pas, quand même pas. La réalité de ce qu'on voit maintenant, c'est que code is law, or by law at least. Dans le sens que c'est ça qui va créer souvent des murs invisibles dans ce qu'on est autorisé à faire ou ce qu'on est autorisé ou pas à faire.
Parfait. Madame, votre nom?
Oui, bonjour. Je m'appelle Justine McIntyre. Je suis élue à la Ville de Montréal, conseillère de ville pour le district de Pierrefonds-Roxboro. J'agis également en tant que critique à l'opposition, la troisième opposition, pour tout ce qui concerne la technologie, le numérique, la ville intelligente, etc. Donc, merci beaucoup, Monsieur Guidouin, pour votre présentation. J'ai deux questions. En fait, la première, c'est que j'aimerais savoir plus sur votre projet Nord ouvert. Et la deuxième question, c'est que vous avez beaucoup parlé de comment on peut mieux découvrir l'intention des citoyens, ce que les citoyens veulent de leur ville. Mais je voudrais savoir ce que vous voyez comme étant le plus grand défi numérique auquel fait face la ville de Montréal. Merci.
OK.
I can say it in English. I'm asking him to give us...
Oh, it's OK. On a un peu de retard.
Je laisse à la discrétion de M. Guinouin. Merci beaucoup.
Donc, le plus gros défi a été soulevé tout à l'heure, à mon avis, c'est la culture technologique de la population. Dans le sens que malheureusement, puis il y a du monde qui dit qu'il faut que tout le monde sache coder. Je ne suis pas sûr que c'est une bonne idée. Je ne suis pas sûr qu'avoir tout le monde qui sait faire du développement, c'est quelque chose de pertinent. Par contre, comprendre certains des éléments, pas comprendre la formule que j'ai montrée, mais comprendre ce qui vient avec la formule, les conséquences de cette formule, ça c'est quelque chose de, à mon avis, central. Donc la capacité, puis ça c'est quelque chose, à mon avis, qui n'existe pas à l'heure actuelle. Soit on est développeur, soit on est néophyte et on comprend pas. Il faut être capable de trouver un milieu qui, à l'heure actuelle, n'existe pas en termes de formation, en termes de compréhension, qui permet autant aux décideurs politiques que les citoyens de comprendre qu'est-ce que les outils numériques qu'on leur propose vont changer dans leur vie quotidienne.
Merci beaucoup. On va
on va passer à la dernière personne speaker. Est-ce que nous avons Madame Gomez-Mont? Oui. Vamos hablar espagnol. On attend pour être certain d'être en ligne. Vous me donnez le go.
Hello.
Hello. Buenas tardes. Allô, allô. Yes, we hear you, but can't see you. Allô? Okay, I'm going to try. Gabriel Gomez-Mont is the director of Mexico City's laboratory, Mexico City's new creative think tank, an exceptional space, a place to ponder social scripts and urban futures from the speculative, even outlandish, to the practical. She has won several international awards and recognition for work in different disciplines and was recently selected as a World City Summit Young Leader. Señora Gomez-Mont, it's working? No? Les joies du direct. On l'a perdu. Allô, allô?
Which? Well.
Yes, we have to wait a couple of seconds. No? We're going to try to call back. 1 minute, yes, otherwise. Allô? Allô, allô? Allô?
Allô?
Oui.
Oui.
Oops, it's my voice, sorry.
I'm sorry.
Allô, allô? On l'a perdu. So, professeur. Aha, I know this music. Allô? Allô, allô? Montreal speaking. Buenas tardes, como va? Parece que no. No. Allô, allô? Sorry.
So, Professor Sroor, no?
So, oui, oui. Right. Bon, on va être juste à right at the time. Merci beaucoup à tous les speakers qui sont venus cet après-midi. Now, we will take a short break until 10 minutes exactly, 5:15. And I will ask you to move to down.
Non.
Ah bon, ben je pense que je vais laisser dans ces cas-là parler le professeur Sroor pour vous pouvez expliquer ce qu'on va faire. Merci beaucoup.
Merci beaucoup, Damien. Je prends mon téléphone. Alors, on va prendre une pause de 10 minutes. We'll have a break of 10 minutes, and then we'll resume here with
the cultural events with, first of all, a talk by Armando Silva, and then the session on night. Then we go downstairs for drink and food and music on the first floor. I just want to say one more thing. The exhibition in the back that you probably have noticed, Remaking Civic Assets on Sherbrooke Street, is a wonderful project designed by architecture students at McGill under the supervision of Professor Talia Dorsey. And so we're very pleased to have collaborated with them, and I invite you to look at it. So, break.